This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
My name is Tony Vu. I'm a chef entrepreneur with a big passion to leverage the power of food for social impact. Founder, chef of Mamang in Flint, Michigan. Also executive chef and co-founder of The Good Bowl in Traverse City. And I'm the founder and executive director of Flint Social Club, capacity building program for marginalized people in the food industry.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you, Tony. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
Being happy-go-lucky. I think when I think of Vietnamese people and what makes me feel at home and feel really connected, there is just this undeniable, like, happy-go-luckiness, I guess, about us and in our ways. Particularly coming from, a history of, strife and coming from war and rebuilding and everything. Some of the most impactful kind of relationships and interactions that I've had have come through knowing these stories of struggle and everything. But throughout it all, just always maintaining like this sort of positivity and optimism and just kind of, human connection throughout it all. At the end of the day, there's always some kind of like smile, some kind of like willingness to share, and a lot of like, just really beautiful community relations in it all. So to me, that's what being Vietnamese comes down to.
You know, it's an interesting answer, happy-go-lucky, because, I haven't heard that yet since all of my time doing this, happy-go-lucky. And I want to sort of spotlight your family before we get into the growing up part of it. Your family is, starting with Bac Le Xuân Khoa and Lê Quỳnh and Ilan and Cô Thái Thanh, well, she's an in-law, but, and Mimi Vu. All of these people are people that I've come into contact with in my life or have, read or have known extensively about. And when I think about those people, I do kind of get this sense of happy-go-lucky. they seem like very positive people. Do you think that that's something to do with the family culture?
I think so. And maybe that's what being Vietnamese, or that's what it means to be Vietnamese to me. I have an awesome family. Even if we don't see each other for years or anything, just being able to come back and just just joke with each other and poke fun and just kind of, connect in these like really, just happy like spaces. It's really, really amazing. And it's something that I think through my lens, growing up without much of a Vietnamese community surrounding me, to kind of have that connection to them and have that perspective of how I've experienced, my kind of, identity and growing into my identity as a Vietnamese person. It's provided a really awesome kind of backdrop to seek out, who I am.
So you didn't grow up around a lot of Vietnamese people?
No, not at all. So I grew up in a tiny farm town called Millington with a population of about, I think it was like 2,000 people or something like that. It's like you know, it's had like one traffic light. You know, everybody knew us. So I apologize. I got my dog being. yeah, it was a really small farm town. So, you know, the story is that my family came over from the war. My dad, through his military contacts, ultimately ended up in Flint, Michigan to do his residency at a hospital. And that's where I was born. And from that program, the town of Millington basically adopted my family. And so we ended up relocating there. My father was set up with a medical practice. And that's where I spent the first 15 years of my life, this like kind of small town community. I wouldn't say I was completely disconnected by any means. That was obviously my everyday life, but I was also really lucky in that, you know, my parents did maintain their connections to the community and friends and family and everything. And so I was able to travel a lot. We spent a lot of time in Houston, spent a lot of time, traveling out to California, where a lot of my relatives are. My father's side of family is in Paris as well. And so I was devoid of the culture by any means, but it was very, very much so. I was raised in a town where we were the only non-white family.
And so, what did you expect yourself to do as you were growing up for the future?
It was pretty typical. I was obsessed with being a doctor. Wanted to be a surgeon. It was pretty much a one-track kind of thing. It wasn't anything that was asked me or anything to you. I just really wanted to do it. I'll never forget it. I remember my father sitting down with me at some point, like maybe I was like, he was like eighth grade or ninth grade or something. And he kind of had the talk with me of like, you know, what I wanted to do, like what direction, everything in life. And, I told him I wanted to be a doctor, and he basically convinced me not to.
Really?
Yeah. Looking back, I totally get it now as well, because, I think where he came from and, you know, how he was a doctor, it was just completely different in an American healthcare system. And it was just more of like this kind of business and grind and things like that. I think in a way, like he actually really enjoyed being in Millington because he just became a straight up, like, you know, country doctor. Like doing house visits and like, you know, exchanging like, you know, like his medical services for like, you know, milk and like, you know, all these like cool like bargain or like barter system kind of stuff. I think in the end, what he told me was that, you know, he knew that I had a really good heart, that I really wanted to help people. But in the end that he didn't think that that was going to be the right field for me.
Okay, so what's the reason you think he said that? What was his assessment?
I don't know. My father and I, like, he came from a very, very kind of stern and disciplined family. My grandfather was a schoolmaster. It was just, you know, they were just very, very, you know, very much the opposite of the lay side of the family.
Yeah, rigid.
Yeah, very rigid. I think part of it was just him assessing and seeing me throughout life and just maybe seeing what, you know, that maybe there was something else out there for me. Maybe also not wanting to not wanting me to just follow in footsteps just because that was what I was supposed to do. Because everybody else, you know, I'm pretty much that whole side of the family is all full of doctors as well. That's a really good question. I'm not really certain, other than it was just kind of maybe that personal connection between father and son and what he saw, you know, where he saw my potential was.
Yeah, because if you think about it, looking back today, that's pretty progressive for that time for anybody to tell your kid, you know, especially if your kid wants to do it, and to tell your kid, look, that my opinion is don't do it, you know. Yeah, very progressive way of looking at career.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he definitely saw my innate talents with, like, you know, math and science and computers and like my interests in all those as well. Like, you know, we were the first family to have a computer in the entire like town. And so, you know, I took to technology at a very young age. And so I think probably also with that and seeing that, you know, he did say that, you know, I think maybe you should get into, you know, into computer science or technology and things like that as well. So I think, you know, he was kind of assessing things with, you know, not only just myself, my personality, but then maybe it's just how the world was kind of shaping up as well.
Yeah. And how the world was shaping up and what you have ultimately decided to do is not computers and not technology and not science. It's very different. It's community and it's food and it's very things that are much more human based. You know, your journey into all of these things of, and we'll get into it, you know, the music and going down to live in South America and all of that stuff. Very different from what it sounds like you're heading into.
Yeah, you know, I think that was the unintended consequence of that that conversation, because you know, I was always good at computers, but and I was interested, but I never really was passionate about that at all. And so ultimately, you know, from that conversation, you know, obviously over the course of the years as well, like I definitely stuck into more of the creative side of things, and you know, ended up you know, dedicating about 15 years of my life after that to being a musician and doing music.
What did you want to do as a musician?
Oh man, so this is gonna take you back to, you know, just being like a young, you know, just like hopeful, like, you know, like I wanted to change the world with music, basically. Excuse me, one second. I'm gonna.
Okay.
So yeah, basically, I wanted to, you know, in my mind, change or save the world. It was like, you know, I was like full of just, you know, energy and like optimism, and like it was, you know, especially like in my upbringing and everything, going through high school and stuff, it was like me against like the man, and like, you know, seeing all the injustices in the world with like, you know, corporations, and like, you know, I got really deep into just like, you know, this kind of sense of like I guess almost like activism of sorts, of like, you know, trying to change people's perspectives and minds and everything, and really you know, tapping into the power of music and creativity to be able to get these messages and everything across.
But why music? Why did you think music would be a channel to change things in the world?
You know, I think that was probably just based off of my life experience. You know, I had always played music. So I started drumming when I was 8 years old. So that was always something that was just like really strong in me. Never in the beginning did I ever think that it was going to be a career or anything like that. But I think as I kind of, you know, maybe the focus of being a doctor and living this other, you know, building this other life started to fade. It was filled with, you know, this excitement of creativity. And, you know, as I kind of delved into more of that path, like it's just started to open up all these different, you know, opportunities and relationships that ultimately just ended up, you know, just kind of like growing me into these kinds of mindsets, you know, and part of, obviously a big part of it too is like, you know, going through high school, going through puberty, like, you know, all the high school, you know, kind of things that one goes through, with like, you know, for particularly for me with like identity and things like that as well. It was just this really amazing place for me to not only explore myself, but then also express myself in a way where I could be free and be authentic.
Got it. And then with so you get into drumming, and this is the first step of the music process for you. What do you do with it?
So, you know, I went through, you know, just kind of like schooling and everything and you know, band classes and things like that. And then, when I went to high school, I ended up, coming to Flint, to go to a private school. And, you know, I was very, very much out of place there. I didn't know anybody. I was this like scrawny, like Asian kid that was like super shy and everything as well. And so, you know, it was through music. I remember like sitting down at the lunch table, and like somehow somebody had found out that I played music, or a good friend, Brent Dutcher, So he came to me and like was asking me, and he's like, "Oh, so you're a drummer?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, I play bass." And then, you know, next thing you know, you're making friends, and you know, you're every day after school, you're going to somebody else's basement to start jamming and everything. And so that kind of like started the path. And so very much, I think music was intrinsically tied to also my development, you know, as a person, my character, you know, growing up through high school.
Yeah, that formative those formative years, having something to grab onto, really helps shape our identity, because it leads us into all of the times that we have free time. We spend it with these sort of people, and it makes us think about you know, the path that we eventually take. And I think that for me, it reminds me of the time that I kind of like was in that music path that early in my life. When you're around people who are like thinking a little bit more freer, the patterns kind of dissipate. They go away.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there was a really amazing kind of scene in place in Flint. It's called the Flint Local 432. And it's I'm pretty sure the nation's oldest all ages music venue. And it was so cool because, like, you know, from all the surrounding like high schools and everything, it was a thing. Like, you could start a band, and you had this venue and this really supportive scene of, like, you know, just all these different misfits. Like, you know, I can only imagine like pulling, like, you know, kids' parents like pulling up to the club, and like, you know, you look at the outside and there's a bunch of like kids with like spike jackets and like, you know, crazy hair and like whatever kind of thing. But it was a really, really awesome scene. And the access that we all had to be able to be creative, create something, be exposed to, like, you know, to the support of not only just your friends, but then also the scene that was kind of built in, and be able to build up things from there, in addition to just have fun, was really, really awesome. And, you know, it was such a formative period of my life that, you know, looking back, it absolutely laid the foundation for a lot of things that I'm currently doing. Especially when it comes to kind of like organizing and networking and things like that as well.
What'd you do after high school?
After high school, you know, I went to college, and so I went to University of Michigan. But I think by then, you know, it was just, I was just one track mind. I was just so passionate about music, and just, you know, I lived, breathed, ate it. I mean, it was everything like to me. And it served me in a lot of really unique ways as well. It wasn't just about, like, you know, having this career and, like, you know, touring and, you know, playing shows and things like that, but also from a personal standpoint for me, you know, it helped me find an outlet for a lot of just sort of like the afflictions that I had like growing up. And so, you know, I was, you know, as a kid, you know, I had these like kind of, I always carried these like sort of, you know, anger, like outbursts and things like that. You know, for the most part, I was a really good kid. And I you know, always meant really well. And was like, you know, just like, you know, always bowed, things like that. But underneath it all, there was definitely something just, you know, just something really, really deep that I never really understood. And you know, and it was a lot of things. It was like anger, it was frustration. It was just like, you know, a lot of these like really, really sort of like dark emotions and stuff that, you know, for the most part would lay hidden. And then there would be these kind of like triggers and outbursts and things like that. And, you know, I would almost like black out or something. And then I would like kind of like, you know, come to or whatever after it all. And then just kind of like see what I did, or be aware of, like, you know, just like the things that I did or said or whatever, things like that. And I would be appalled. It was like so far from who I was and wanted to be as a person. And so in a way, I feel like music kind of laid that foundation where, it, you know, it, in a certain aspect, it kind of saved me, I think. Because what I found was that through music, I was able to actually express all these intense emotions and feelings, whatever it was that I felt that was like bottled up in me. And I had a space and a venue to be able to express all that. But it didn't come, you know, the effect of it was that through a show or, you know, performance or whatever, almost like this alchemy would happen where, like, even though it came from this place of, like, you know, this dark place or whatever, how people would perceive it would be the complete opposite. And people would be inspired and, like, amped up or, like, you know, whatever. And so for me, it kind of, you know, I guess in the beginning, at least, it served as this process for me to kind of, like, work through and get a lot of these things out in a very, you know, kind of, like, safe space. You know, I always like to say that, like, you know, because, like, my style of drumming, especially earlier on, I was just, like, just balls to the wall, just super intense,
mad,
like, threw everything out. Yeah, madman. I would like bleed all of my drums and everything. Like, it was, like, very violent and, like, you know, just throw everything that I had, you know, at every show. It was like almost like I was going to war or something like that. And, you know, it helped me really hone in and kind of laid a sort of foundation for me to actually, you know, take control of those emotions in a certain way. You know, and yeah, it really laid the basis for me for you know, kind of the rest of my journey of self-discovery as well. I'm 40 years old. I'm the youngest of everything, pretty much. So, like, you know, I think later on in life, I'm starting to understand more about, like, the older cultures, my, you know, aunts and uncles, my parents, you know, just, like, my grand, you know, and everything as well. So I can only speak to my personal experience. But, you know, I think one aspect of it is this resiliency of getting through adversity. And, you know, I guess it's not like that we didn't have suffering, like you said. You know, I can take, you know, we can take things from, like, famines, from, like, you know, obviously all these different wars. I mean, with Japanese, with the Chinese, with, you know, just colonialism. I mean, there's just so much within that where I think even if you look at it as a whole, where, you know, where was there even room for a Vietnamese identity within all, when we're constantly trying to just fight for that identity? We have this huge history between Vietnam and China of, like, you know, China, you know, basically coming in, you know, conquering us, then us rising back up, and then, but then what would, you know, historically what would happen was that the best parts, you know, I say that lightly, but, like, the best parts of, or what we saw that worked for us, such as Confucianism or whatever it was, we'd kick the Chinese out, but then we would take, you know, absorb these kind of, like, other cultural things as well. And so I think that also speaks to a certain kind of adaptability, and getting back to the resiliency and everything that we have as a culture. But yeah, I see it too. And it's something that I kind of saw in real time as I started to, you know, visit Vietnam and come back every year and everything, and just seeing all the changes, you know. There's clearly so much talent creatively in Vietnam. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, you know, today it's you know, arguably, you know, just almost a different group of people than our families, or, you know, previous generation. It's just,
yeah,
it's on fire. I love it. Love to see it.
Yeah, it's really cool. But, and what I've seen over the years is, like, you know, on one end, you know, our creativity, you know, it has been channeled into a lot of copying, you know. And so whether it's, like, you know, I'll take, for example, the art studios that are there, you can walk into some of these art studios and you'll see perfect recreations of, like, all these masterworks, and, you know, they're like, you know, and they're just chock full, and you have all these artists just, like, you know, recreating all these things, right? And I remember it was so striking to me because, you know, as a tour some of these places and, like, hearing about, like, you know, the artists and talents and things, and, you know, and the biggest question that I had was, like, you know, with all this talent, why is it being channeled into, you know, copying masterworks and, like, doing these things that were already done? Like, where is this outlet for actual self-discovery and, like, creativity outside of those kinds of, like, parameters and everything? And I think you look back at it today, and it's, like, it's completely starting to shift, especially with all the younger generations and everything, and more exposure to the rest of the world and the inspiration that comes from that as well. So, you know, it's really, really complex. Like, I don't know if there is an actual, like, you know, answer, like, to that, but I think there is a combination in just kind of, like, our history, and, you know, just how Vietnam has been just this place that has continually been like, you know, conquered and controlled, and that set up against this you know, this kind of, I, you know, the culture and like the Vietnamese people just really fighting to have our own sense of identity throughout it all. So I think it's, the answer is probably rooted somewhere within there.
Yeah, and I think I'm always looking for the complexity answer, and I think you hit it right in the head. It's like, if you're dealing with surviving, there's no other complexity other than finding bread to put on your table.
Yeah. Yeah, because you look at these different movements of like, you know, like the Renaissance or like whatever it is, and like, you know, all these cultural explosions came from prosperous times. You know, you didn't have to worry about like, you know, food, like, you know, there were strong economies and everything. And so because of these, you know, successes or these strong societies, then the time was created to be able to explore more of these kinds of, you know, art forms and expressions.
It's a good point. So you eventually made your way down to South America, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that journey?
Yeah, that's a really, really talk about complex things. So, you know, I'll try to be mindful of time and everything, but, ultimately what came of, you know, I guess like my band music life and career was, by the end of it, you know, being based in Flint, and, you know, we went through, you know, well, basically it was the opioid crisis. It hit Flint first, or it was one of the early places where it hit, and it hit really, really hard. And so long story short, you know, I was the only one out of my band that wasn't a heroin addict. And so, you know.
Wait. That's heavy. You're telling me that all of your band members and the people, I mean, there's always band members coming in and out. There's always people around bands. And you're saying that basically in your world, you're the only one who didn't get caught up in the heroin crisis of that era.
Yeah. I mean, shit got really, really dark. Let's just say that. And it was a really, really difficult position and time in my life, because, you know, these were like, I was in one band this entire time, you know, since high school, and, you know, they're my brothers. And as things started to progress and everything, you know, this whole kind of charge of like wanting to save the world with music then turned to wanting to save my brothers through music. And so I went through this whole period where I was like, you know, I did everything. I was like booking all these shows, like those tours, like, you know, just organize everything. I mean, I was basically running and just basically put the band on my back. And in my thought process, at least, you know, I could, grow the band, expose us to like, you know, all these like great things and opportunities and things like that. And somehow that would get them change to switch things. Change things, whatever it was. It was so hard because, like, you know, like the thing that held me for so long was that I didn't want to give up on them. And, you know, it things got so bad to the point where, you know, for the first time ever, like, I started to think about things outside of, you know, that tunnel vision of sorts. And this is where life starts to kind of, you know, lift its veil of sorts. And, you know, through a series of just kind of like different events of awakenings of sorts, I started to, you know, see life more through the lens of myself, and, you know, just my own kind of path of healing and spirituality and self-discovery. And so the more and more, you know, that started to open up, and I started having those kind of, you know, that dialogue with myself, and the more I started to understand that what I was doing, I was doing it because I just wanted to heal myself. Like, I wanted to feel good. I wanted to know that I was helping and everything by helping other people. But at the end of it all, and what really started this whole journey that led me to Peru, was that I needed to heal myself. If I really want to help somebody, then I need to make sure that I'm right, and my spirit's right, and that I'm operating from my heart, not from these ideas or deflecting certain things that I was dealing with at the time onto others and other situations. So that was kind of like the first step in changing that mindset. And it was a really, really interesting time in life because, you know, as my spirituality started to open up and I started to kind of explore these different paths, I mean, there's really no other way to explain it. Like there was like magic basically started happening in my life. And I started feeling, not only feeling, but also seeing connections, you know, to my family, to my ancestors. It really felt like, you know, in particular during this phase that my grandfather, who I'd never met before, I'd always heard stories about how amazing he was, how creative he was. He was like this, you know, champion calligrapher. You know, he's a medicinal, like a really powerful medicinal healer as well. Had always been like really curious. You know, I'd seen like a couple of photos of him. He looks like a wizard, basically.
Wow.
But never really knew anything.
On the lay side or the Vu side?
On the lay side.
Of course.
And so, yeah. And so.
I'm just kidding.
No, it's true. I mean, that was part of this whole journey. It was just like really understanding and getting to know that side of my family. I would say like during this period, I really felt his presence. Like he was helping guide me, like, you know, through all this and like leading me in certain directions. So all this kind of, you know, stuff starts happening. You know, I start going through it all. Like I got really into just like reading, like and studying, just like, you know, just different, you know, just, I would say just kind of like, you know, spiritual people, masters, books, things like that, and just really starting to develop, you know, my own connection to it all, and you know, some really amazing things started to happen, and you know, I. As I go through this whole process, I started this process of basically analyzing myself, my life, you know, my habits, the things that I'm doing, realizing what really wasn't serving me or my purpose, and then just starting to kind of like let go of these things, or consciously knowing that like I wanted to let go of them, move them, or heal them, whatever it was. And as I started to do that, like, you know, this kind of process opened up to where, you know, the things that I would remove from my life, they basically would create more space for these other, you know, really beautiful things to kind of come in and help me along with the process. And so by the end of it all, after going through these and just kind of getting all these like really amazing signs, you know, during this period too, like, you know, during the darkest part of it all, like I would say for about 5 years or so, like I didn't have dreams anymore. And during this whole process, I started having really vivid dreams. Some were kind of repeating dreams as well, like visions and things like that. And so, you know, during this process, I started dreaming about being in this place. And I was on a mountaintop, and, you know, I'll never forget it. I was like on this mountaintop, and like these like clouds are like, I was so high, like these clouds are like kind of passing through me, and I can feel like, you know, just kind of like, you know, just I feel it right now, actually, you know, just like the kind of tingles of like that you get from it all, like the coolness of like the clouds and everything. I remember looking across a valley and there was like another mountain right there that was like even bigger kind of thing. And this dream just kept happening like over and over again. And, you know, I remember one day I was like sitting at my computer, and I was like checking my email or something. And, you know, I saw a side banner ad for Peru. And the photo that was used for that ad was the same exact place that was in my dreams. And so I saw that, and it was just like full stop, like what the heck is going on kind of thing. And you know, that opened up a whole series of kind of, you know, just events. Like I don't want to even want to say coincidences, because they weren't. It was definitely kind of like a kismet kind of thing. Like, you know, I felt like I was being told or called to go to this place. And so during this process, you know, I'm going through all this processing and everything, and I finally come to the decision and to just break up with my band. And I was like, this is it. Like, you know, life is leading to a new path and I have to leave this behind. And it was one of the most difficult decisions that I have had in my entire life. But I did it. And I also realized that how much space the band had taken, you know, in my life, my identity and everything. And when I finally made that decision to move on, you know, it not only did I feel like so much weight off of me, but also I realized that I had literally moved an ocean's worth of space for this new things to kind of come into. And so, you know, through a series of other events, I ended up going to Peru. I didn't know anybody, didn't even speak Spanish. I just had the opportunity to purchase a ticket, and I did, and left it at that. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up there. So I went without, without any clue other than just kind of this connection to, you know, my grandfather, to like, you know, the universe, and just trying to follow the signs that ended up placing me there.
You know, we're like deep into our interview, and we are both food people, and we have not even talked about food. And what gets me about doing these interviews is that very thing is, before people even get to where they need to go in their life, the point where they're starting to do things that are kind of in line with who they are, we go through all this circuitous paths, right? Like, we just go and we're all discovering. And I hope that the young Vietnamese generations, and or even young anybody that can hear these stories, understand that, you know, it takes a long time to settle in into the things that we are meant to be doing. And sometimes what we're meant to do is just almost a transitory rite of passage as well. It's not permanent, and it's just on our journey to dying.
Yeah. Right?
It's just on the journey to death.
Yeah, you know, I see that in a lot of ways, of just like even with relationships as well. Mm-hmm. Whether they're long term, short term, whatever. You know, the girlfriend I had at the time, she played a huge role in helping me get to that point, like me understanding my own self-worth. And you know what I was doing, and the environment, and you know that I was choosing to place myself in, and that, you know, that I was worth more, that I was I was meant to do, you know, I don't know if it's like bigger, better things necessarily, but that it wasn't that, you know, this really dark place, you know, that I found myself in. And so, you know, and that relationship, I think, served its purpose, like very specifically,
yeah,
to me get to that point. And even when, you know, I think about, you know, my time in South America, you know, I mean, I can literally look back and see how, you know, I met this person that then and had this conversation that then led me to this person that led me to here, and then ultimately, you know, I'm having like, you know, a really, really profound, you know, experience where like I'm understanding and peeling back these layers of myself. So yeah, I think that's a really, really great point, is like, you know, it is that, you know, nothing is forever. You know, it is this kind of, some things are kind of transitory, but you know, that is the embrace and acceptance of that, I think, yeah, is something that we as human beings have a lot of difficulty in. Because we want to maintain things, we grasp for things, and we don't want to let go.
I have to circle back to the band members. Do you know how they've all ended up?
Yeah, I still keep in touch with them. Unfortunately, one passed. The others are actually doing really well. You know, they were able, it was their own, like, you know, journey and everything, but yeah, they made it to the other side, so to speak. And one of them still is an amazing musician, and he's still, you know, on that path, and he's amazing, you know, has this amazing career as a musician. others just kind of like, you know, just stepped out of it and started to do just different things. So.
Yeah. And before we get into the food stuff, I want to address the whole Flint, or not even address it. I have a lot of questions about Flint and the water crisis. And, you know, how has Flint changed in the last decade or so with all the adversity?
It's changed a lot. You know, things are definitely brighter in Flint. There's a lot more economic activity and development. I think more importantly, there's a lot of, it could be better, but there's more opportunities for the community to actually lay claim to, you know, to our city and express themselves as well. You know, in a way, I feel like this whole resiliency that we talk about, like it's so alive here and connected here in Flint as well. You know, I think, you know, we come up in blips because, you know, if it's not the murder capital and it's like, you know, the auto industry stuff, and then it's like the water crisis, like, you know, all these things. But, you know, at the end of the day, like the people are here, the community is here. Like we have, you know, gotten through all these things because of like the strength and the bonds of the community. You know, we look out for each other. And, you know, while everybody sees Flint as this place where it's like, you know, it needs to be saved, you know, we don't need saving as a community. We just need opportunities. You know, it's there's such an amazing, like built-in, like hustle and like grit to people who are from Flint, and survivalism, and a lot of creativity too. Like, you know, I always make the joke that like, you know, in Flint, the same person that, you know, fixes your car, you know, can also do plumbing, can also, you know, do your electrical work, and then is probably your weed dealer as well. You know, and so there is this amazing hustle in Flint where everybody just like does whatever it takes, you know, to survive, and they end up finding themselves in all these different capacities because of that.
Yeah, and it's awesome to hear you you have such love for that resiliency, because you know, it's very easy to label ourselves as Vietnamese and Viet pride and all of this stuff, but there's more to just that idea of being Vietnamese, because you are a Vietnamese who is very attached to your community in Flint. And the beauty of that is, like, you know, all these big cities, New Yorkers or Angelenos, are always, you know, East Coast, West Coast, but there's another Tony Vu somewhere in Brazil or another part of the world that is very attached to their community and doing big things in their community and being part of the fabric of the community. And I am so proud to hear that, you know, that you've connected and you're taking care of it's just people, right? Just people that you are taking care of in your community. And I think that that's so such an amazing thing that you can say, you know what, this is the most important aspect of living, is the people around us.
Oh yeah, and you know, everybody in Flint gets it too. Like, as much as, you know, I you know, take care of the community also takes care of me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what makes this place so special, is that the strength and the bonds within that the community that exists here. It's really incredible. And it doesn't exist in many places, at least as far as I've seen from a citywide level. You know, everybody's so supportive of what anybody is doing here. And we all just want each other to succeed and win in life. And it's a really, really incredible place, like, especially coming from, you know, this sort of, you know, baseline of, you know, just kind of like suffering and everything. You know, I joke with, you know, some of my friends sometimes, and it's, you know, it almost seems like everybody in Flint is in some way, shape or form, like, you know, broken, right? And we all really connect on that, and we all uplift each other, because we see each other authentically, you know, kind of, you know, as community members, as brothers and sisters. And it's a really, really amazing community to be a part of.
Before I started the podcast, I had read different articles about you years ago and your work. And, you know, always when you see a Vietnamese name, you're so proud. I'm so proud of it always. You've done a lot. The footprint of what you've done in Flint is a lot. So I don't know how to unpack this right now, but we got to find a way to start the story from, I guess, leaving Peru to now you going on to your journey in the food space.
Yeah, so, you know, my whole journey in Peru, it really kicked off this 5-year period of intense self-discovery. And prior to this, I had no inclination to even try to do anything with food. I love food. My mom's food is amazing, just like every Vietnamese mom's. But my mom's food is like really, really incredible. You know, and so I've always had a love for food. And, you know, my family did have a restaurant growing up. I was just a little kid, just kind of like bumped around everything as well. But, you know, I never really saw myself like, you know, cooking like that by any means. And so, you know, so I guess like starting with Peru, you know, it was really this huge step in my life to really take accountability for myself and just put more work and effort into myself and understanding myself and ultimately my development. And, you know, some really amazing things happened there. Like I had so many cool experiences. I ended up like mountain climbing, you know, and to kind of circle back to this whole vision that I had with Peru, I went to that place. I found myself in a small town called Pisac, which is in the Sacred Valley. It's just not too far from Cusco. And I remember being there, and there's like, you know, one of the last kind of like fully intact ruins that is Machu Picchu is sits at the top of there. And so, you know, I remember going up there with a friend that I'd met. He's telling me about this place and like, let's go. So we made plans, went up there in the morning. Hiked all the way to the top, and you know, when we get to the top and, you know, kind of walk around and like we get to the ruins and I'm going through, and then all of a sudden I look up and it hits me, and I'm standing there, the clouds are passing through me, and I look across, and there's that mountain, and it was just this it's indescribable, but it was a place where like time, space, everything stopped. And somehow I just felt whole, and I was shocked at first, but then also I felt like I belonged. Like it was just something where I remember just like smiling and just being like, wow, there really is magic in this world.
Wow.
And so that kind of, you know, led me, especially with being in the mountains as well, to really pursue this kind of, you know, discovery and philosophy of being up there. And so I got really, really into to mountain climbing, and just kept going higher and higher, and, you know, just got so many amazing life lessons and everything from it all as well. Just, you know, when you're up there and you're just like a speck, and like, you know, you're in the shadows of these like massive, like powerful, like, you know, kind of, you know, mountains, you know, it really puts a lot of things into perspective of like what actually matters, you know, at least in that space. And so I was able to experience a lot of that. And I think it allowed me to also kind of zoom back and just like really look at life and all the possibilities and purpose and just like all these two kinds of, you know, things. And really just kind of reflect and draw upon those as inspiration. And so did Peru, and had this incredible experience, and, you know, ended up coming back. And then I think a month later, I ended up going to Vietnam for the first time. And that was really, really incredible. For me, because I had this idea, for one, that, you know, basically, so growing up, and I think this is kind of like a shared thing, is, you know, I had this kind of identity crisis of sorts, you know, particularly with my situation, like grew up in Millington, like, you know, just not being surrounded by much of an Asian community, let alone Vietnamese. You know, growing up in a musical world where, like, you know, you're looked at as an Asian and just kind of like, you know, you're escalated and just kind of like, it's kind of, you know, like, what are you doing here kind of thing. And then I would play, and then all of a sudden you just be like, oh, you're cool now, I can talk to you kind of thing, you know? So it was like, it was always like me, like, trying to prove myself and self-worth and who I was and things like that. So, so I always had this idea in my head that, like, I would go to Vietnam, the motherland, you know, I'd be with my people, and I would finally, like, you know, I don't know what I thought, but like some red carpet was being thrown, rolled out, and like be embraced as, like, you know, like, you know, coming home as the sun or something like that, right? And I get there, and everybody thinks that I'm like either like mixed French or Japanese. And you know, I speak Vietnamese to people, and they're just like, oh, you speak such good Vietnamese. I'm just like, I am Vietnamese. They're like, no, you're not, like, kind of thing. And by that point, for me, it was like, I realized just kind of just how insignificant to me, at least the weight that I was putting on this sense of like identity and belonging.
Wow.
Because mm-hmm. by then, I had gone through so many different life experiences, was able to meet so many different people, and just had like have all these like really amazing connections, that I realized that I'm actually like, you know, I'm me, like I'm a child of the world. I can get along with, you know, pretty much anybody, you know, fit in pretty much like, you know, anywhere and in any situation. And to me, that was like kind of like the big cosmic joke of sorts, where it was just like, you know, you're fine, like stop stressing about it. And so that was huge. And what I can say is that throughout this all as well, you know, I did have a lot of really profound experiences based around the food. First in Peru, you know, I'll never forget one of the big ones was, you know, I was trying to find this kind of like, you know, this mystical waterfall of sorts. Like, you know, I was in the jungle in the Amazon, and it was against all the advice of all the locals. Like, you know, I just wanted to go out and try to find it on my own. It was like eight-hour hike to get there, and I was like, I could do it, whatever. So here I am, you know, 10 hours later, and I'm lost in the jungle. So I remember coming up to this kind of like river crossing, and you know, I stopped to eat some food that I had packed, and you know, it was basically in this place where I was like, man, like, I just need to get back. And I think by that time too, like this sort of dialogue had opened up with the jungle. You know, when you're in the jungle like that, and there's no civilization or anything, and you're just literally just surrounded by, you know, this wild world or kingdom, where, you know, a million things surrounding you can kill you, and a million things can probably heal you as well. You know, it's just this dialogue kind of starts to open up, and these different senses start to open up as well. And you start to kind of like see things differently, hear things differently. You know, it becomes very intuitive as well. And so, you know, I'm sitting at this kind of stream crossing, you know, eating a sandwich, and like, finally gets to the point where I realized how stupid I was. And so I, basically apologized to the jungle, and, you know, basically asked for a safe passage for like a way back. And, when I say that, you know, out of the corner of my eye, I see this like black blob that like comes, and it just goes, hits my ponytail, and then it goes off. And then it was so quick, it was just like that. And then as I processed it, what I realized was that it was an eagle that came through, like grabbed my tail and then went that way. And I remember the first thing that entered my head when you know, that contact happened was, go this way. And so like happens, and then I'm like, process it and put it together. And I was like, wait, what? And so realized that was my, you know, my that was the answer. And so I followed the river across that way, leads me out of the jungle back to this, you know, to kind of like a trail, follow the trail, and then I end up getting coming upon this campesino, which is like a, you know, kind of like a farm. And I see this lady there that's like, knitting something out of weave, and she sees me. And so naturally, she's like, I'm probably like all haggard and everything. And so she's like, comes out and she's, trying to talk to me. I'm trying to speak to her in broken Spanish. She speaks Quechua because she's like indigenous. And, not really much is like being, is being communicated. But then she looks at me and she goes, she points, she's like, like that. And I was like, universal language. I was like, yeah, of course I would love to. She's like, come here. So I go inside of her hut and, sit down on the dirt floor, and she like lays out this spread of like plantains and like fish and like potatoes. And, I'm just like, it's beautiful. It's like, I'm just eating this like beautiful food, being like, poured with a lot of energy and love and everything. And during this whole time, we're just chatting back and forth. And even though we're just like, it's using like our own words or whatever, we were laughing like in stitches, just like saying things, communicating. It was like, it was really, really surreal. Somehow we had found a way to communicate, basically. By the end of it all, I don't know if she knew that I was trying to get back to like whatever, but she kind of like points me on my way, and I like follow her directions, and it gets me back to the village that I came from. And so for me, that was kind of one of the really first really profound experiences where I saw the transcendental power of food, and just how it could, really just break down barriers, whether it was like culturally, language, whatever it was. And so that was kind of like the first morsel of sorts that I got that kind of led me on to other experiences in life. The other part would be, going to Vietnam, obviously, and experiencing all the food there and all the joy and everything that comes from it all. Meeting my cousins that I didn't even know existed from my father's, first marriage, and meeting them, hearing their stories, understanding, the struggles and everything that they went through, seeing their personalities, how creative they were, how happy they were as well, and just like, being brought into that world and like sharing, these conversations and love like over meals, it left such a huge impact on me and my heart, and just how I could see, how I saw that was expressed through food. That by the end of it all, after 5 years and just like, going through, a number of these types of experiences, I kept coming back every winter. And I would just, I was doing IT contracting at the time, and then, it was just a way to kind of, get through. But knowing that I wanted to do something else, like something bigger was at play, and like just kind of over time, I wouldn't even say it was a decision. It was like another one of those things where like doors were open and I just chose to walk through them. And that's how I got started. I basically bought a food truck without any experience, never really worked in a restaurant or anything before as well. Worked on it for a summer, and then armed with my mom's recipe and even her help, like starting it off, just kind of hit the ground running.
Before we even get into that journey with the food truck, I want to ask you about ceremony in Peru, because I feel like the stories that you talk about have a lot to do with magic and this idea of allowing ourselves to be open to this spiritual side that is not related to Christianity or Buddhism, our typical religions in Vietnam. There are different parts of South American spiritual practices. And I think that you and I have talked about you having experience in the idea of ceremonies and whatnot. And can you tell me about the magical side of these ceremonies in Peru?
Yeah. I had kind of, laid the groundwork, I guess, to enter more of that spiritual and kind of older ceremonial, like ancient, like kind of world of that. And so, when I got to Peru for the first time, I had one contact that had set me up with somebody that they knew, and end up staying with them. And from them, they had sent me up with some of their friends to just kind of like, you know, hang out, like whatever. And this group of friends were very much so from that world of spirituality, of plant medicine and everything. And, you know, we started having these conversations.
And you had never done anything before? You never was part of that world before?
Well, not in the ceremonial sense. You know, I guess prior to this, you know, I had dabbled in, you know, psychedelics and everything, and kind of had an affinity of sorts, especially when it comes to kind of, you know, the expansive aspects and the creativity and things that come from that all. But this was something completely different. And, you know, I gained, obviously a profound respect, for, you know, working with consciousness when you enter these kinds of realms and the responsibility that really comes with it and how it ties into, you know, these bigger pictures of spirituality and connection and things. And so, you know, I basically just started, you know, meeting people and like we'd have conversations and one thing would lead to another and like, you know, there were more aspects of even more self-discovery. And that's what actually led me to Cusco. So I got to Cusco and met some more people as well. And, you know, basically I was just started getting connected to this larger world of ceremony. And so when I was in Cusco, and it was almost like a weird like vetting process of sorts. And this really interesting thing happened. Like when and with that group when I first came to Peru, they basically told me that there was somebody that I would meet in Cusco that I needed to go there, and that she was like my sister, basically. And I remember going there with this thought of like, I have to find this person, well, whatever kind of thing. And, you know, through these different meetings and contacts and, you know, the network and everything, I end up at this shop. You know, there's a few shaman kind of like shops in Cusco and in Pisac. So I was in Pisac and was talking to the shop owner, who is a shaman, and you know, we would just start chatting and everything. And I think right off the bat, like, you know, like she was a sesame of sorts, and opened herself up a little bit more at, you know, asked me to come around like later and everything. And, you know, I guess like I passed some kind of test, whatever it was. And in the end, you know, she invited me to do an ayahuasca ceremony. And so, you know, the evening comes of the ceremony, and I get there, and, you know, there's like a small group that's just kind of like waiting around to be let in. And I see this girl and it's Claudia. And immediately when we get there, we just kind of like look at each other, and like there's instantly some kind of like weird whatever connection kind of thing. And you know, we end up chatting, and I tell her, I was like, I think I was supposed to like meet you or something. And she's like, basically said the same thing. She was like, yeah, like, you know, there's something weird is like going on here. And I end up in the ceremony that night. And that entire ceremony, it was a group of, I think, about five people. And essentially that entire ceremony became about me. And the five people that were in there were there to support me through this whole process of really going into, you know, the core of like, you know, just whatever my demons were and everything, whatever my affliction and everything were. And they were there. There was like three other shamans in addition to that. And they were all there to support me, on this kind of like, you know, transition of sorts, and journey for me to get to the other side. And this was the culmination of everything that I went through from the time that, you know, I broke up with the band, and ended up in Peru and trying to find like a new beginning, whatever it was. And, you know, that, I mean, this is a whole nother podcast as far as like, yeah, what happened with them at all. But what I can tell you is that by the end of it all, I remember, you know, I was in a boat of sorts. I remember laying down, and it was death. Like I had a spiritual death of sorts. I remember laying down, like passing through this dark tunnel. There's like firelits and everything. And then I get to the other side and everything opens up, like the sea or whatever. And then like, I sit back up again and I look and I see myself heading towards Vietnam, which is where I ended up a month later, and you know, understood the family side of myself and that story and how it weaved into so many of these things that I felt growing up and just how it was all connected. And it gave me, you know, an understanding that it wasn't just me, that I wasn't just like, you know, this person with all this anger or whatever it was, that there was actually a lot of suffering throughout my family. And that it was all interconnected.
You know, I've challenged religion growing up, the spirituality of the theory of spirituality. And, you know, and this is a very superficial challenge, you know, because the rejection of Catholicism from my experiences overshadowed so much other people's experiences or ideas of spirituality. So when I think about like your experience and your family and who they are, and you know, it's very different from ending up in Peru in an ayahuasca ceremony, and the beautiful lineage of the work that your family does, and you know, it's very different from ending up in Peru getting a message that's, you know, could be considered very woo-woo, right? Like, you know, yeah, this is all like, but there's a reality that comes from all of those sensations that you feel in the vibrations of coming out of the ceremony. And I've gone through an ayahuasca ceremony as well. And, you know, it's something that is a very real thing. But at the same time, there's a lot of interpreting that you have to kind of do to get to the other side. So I want to ask you, did you arrive at these interpretations in just one shot, or was there a series of these things that made you ultimately believe in the direction that you were going into?
It was definitely a series of things. I think that some of these epiphanies of sorts were concentrated around the ceremonies, but you know, it's so much of it is it is subjective, you know.
Yeah.
And from one aspect, I could look at it and, you know, as the experiencer of it all, and it was magic and it was amazing, and like, you know, you become one with the universe, you see everything, you see your past lives, you know, you it's very just kind of like you know, mystical and everything, and that's really real. Like I went through that, like I experienced it all. On the other end, I can kind of look back at it as well, and it's just like, well, clearly I was under this influence, you know, like, you know, there's like, you know, all these other aspects, like, you know, that were involved. And so, you know, for me, you know, what I think one is it's your personal journey of it all. And it's not necessarily like a solution, let's say.
Yeah.
It's a tool, you know, and you don't need ayahuasca to be able to do these things. You don't, you know, need to be in ceremony. You definitely don't need to go to Peru to like, you know, to put yourself on a path to heal yourself or understand yourself in these ways. It's definitely not for everybody either. You know, I mean, I had a hard time reconciling it because, like, you know, especially when you spend so much time, you know, in this world of sorts of like mysticism, magic, and all these things, and I'm like, you know, climbing mountains and all this stuff, and like having all these epiphanies, you know, when I would come back, I would say that I was like drunk on the light, like, you know, I was like, bless this, bless that, like, you know, I could not, you know, I there was very few people that I could actually talk to and sound like I was at least somewhat sane, because I was just so far removed from like the shared world that everybody else kind of is in. And so what that taught me was that this was for me, and yes, I can share it. And to be honest, this is really the first time I've ever shared it, at least to this capacity, with an outside world. But you know, it is your own journey. It's your own story, and it's meant for you. And for me, what I saw was that through these experiences, I was led to this sort of crossroads of spirituality and creativity. You know, these worlds, these things came from my ability to connect them. Obviously, one from like, you know, just my mind and just like, you know, these sorts of worlds and instances and things like that. Like that all comes from me. That's all from within here. And my ability to connect those experiences to these larger aspects of life, you know, family, you know, work, whatever, you know, whatever it is, trauma, things like that. That's what I did. And that's how I was able to make sense, not only of that experience, but then life as a whole. You know, you could probably, or at least some people probably could, you know, at least get a similar kind of resolution by seeing a therapist or something, you know, whatever it is, whatever your path is. You know, you could do yoga, you could start meditating, whatever, you know, there's a number of ways to access these things, but I think, you know, it's different for everybody. And, you know, for me, and I don't want to say struggle with it, but, you know, to be able to live that kind of life and be that entrenched in that world, but then also now pull out and be very much so in this life and society and everything, but still try to maintain those connections. You know, it's a struggle, but it's always there. And really what it is, and the X factor in all, is that it's you. All of that comes from you. You know, and if I've learned anything, I've learned like how capable the human spirit is, how resilient it is, and how it can actually, you know, we don't give ourselves enough credit for, I think most of us don't give ourselves enough credit for what we're actually capable of.
You know, as I listen to you, I think about how shitty it is to be a second generation Vietnamese. And here's what I mean. These things that we go through, how can we explain this to our parents? You know, I mean, the depth of being drunken on the light, that concept of like being drunk on the light of being in Peru and all the magic and having it articulated to your mom and dad at some point, you know, because I come out of a retreat and my wife goes to the retreat. We call it a retreat, and that's the only thing that we can say. It's just a retreat. But we can't talk about the intricacies of the structure of what's going on at these ceremonies. And that's a shitty part about being second generation. So when I look at my children, I pray to some spiritual being out there that it does not happen to myself and my children, that we lose a generation of communication as a result of the language or this barrier to say, fuck it. We just have to be able to be fiercely open and candid about our experiences. And I hope that we can inspire ourselves to either push it out with our children and the third generation, or reverse it and try to push it back upwards with our parents. Because the beauty of hearing these stories from you and people like you is that there's this other way of being, this other completely different way of seeing, you know, because the Vietnamese, we have our culture and then we have Buddhism and Catholicism, and that's sort of like the limit of where we kind of experience life in those frameworks.
Yeah, you know, and what I could say is that, you know, maybe it's okay to not be able to explain the whole story. I mean, you're right. How do you? I will never be able to fully articulate what I went through. you know, especially in like one shot or like, you know, a book or something like that. I mean, I can do my best for sure.
Yeah.
But there aren't enough words in all the languages combined to even begin to be able to paint that full picture, because it hits on so many different levels and layers, you know, of your own being, of your existence, of your history, of your family, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, that's something that I had to try to reconcile. And what I realized through it all is that some of that is just for me, you know, that's my story. And like, you know, I can share it with certain people or whatever, but you know, all of it's going to be just fragments of the greater thing. And I think really, to me, that's what life is. You know, if you pull it all the way back, you know, we're all connected.
Yeah.
We're all born from this same thing, whatever it is. It's like, there's no separation. I mean, you can look at it, you know, spiritually, you can look at it from science with like, you know, just straight up like molecules, whatever, like we're all, you know, this, we're all connected, right? The beauty of it all is that we can actually articulate these things in different ways. And the story might not, you know, come across, and then and people might not find a connection. Not everyone might not find a connection to it, but certain people will. And I think ultimately that's what this notion of God or the universe or whatever it is, whatever your name for it is, that's all we can do is try to explain this big, vast expanse of the shared experience through our fragments that we own and that we know, whether it's through a poem, through a mathematical equation, a song, you know, a piece of art. We're all drawn, we're all pulling from that same collective
source. You know, energy,
mm-hmm. source. And we're explaining it and we're articulating those stories, you know, with our gifts and our abilities. And to me, that's where, you know, this confluence of like science, religion, whatever it is, we're all trying to explain the same thing. You know, how do things work? Why do they work? You know, you can look at it through God, or you can look at it through like, you know, theories, whatever, you know, computations, whatever it is. You know, and so I think part of it for me at least was just owning that and knowing that, you know, I have a lot of stories to tell, and they don't just have to come through like, you know, one sitting of a podcast. There's also different ways to express it. You know, I express my journey to greater masses through food and through trying to help other people find themselves. You know, they're going to do it in their food identities. They're going to do it through a different process that I did, obviously. But in the end, what I got from all of that is a place where I can be free and authentically myself. And that's all that I want, you know, really for the world.
That's so crazy. Cause on, you know, when people will hit the download or, you know, to check out this episode, they'll just see a bunch of food stuff, right? From a person named Tony Vu, right? And it's just, you know, they're probably going into it expecting that we're going to hear all this food stuff, this food journey. And for the 90% of the whole episode, we've been talking about this journey that eventually ends up in your food expression. And what you just said is the way that people will experience your experience, will experience your experience, is through the food that they eat. And that's such a beautiful, beautiful idea.
Yeah, you know, it's, I'm really lucky and I'm really grateful to be able to have that expression, you know, and I still love music. And, you know, I think through drumming, I learned how to tap into my creativity, and I see life through rhythms and everything as well. And at the end of the day, I cook like I drum, you know, I draw from that same source. You know, I have those same rhythms that are in it all, like, you know, I find the same joy and everything out of it. So, you know, we're not one dimensional beings. Like, you know, we have, you look at somebody and they're sure there's a projection of something, but then that projection to you is completely different than what who they are as a mother, you know, a father, a brother, a sister, a friend, so on and so forth. So, you know, it's really just, for me, I just love all those different aspects of things, like, you know, and that's really what makes us unique. And it's just, how can you articulate those things? You know,
yeah.
And sat down, came coming back, I was able to actually have that conversation with mom. And like, she kind of got it, you know. With my dad, it was very different. I didn't explain to him, like, you know, what I, you know, just like what I explained to my mom, let's say. But what I did, the conversation I did have with him was just the understanding that I got about our relationship. So I sat down with him, chatted with him about, like, you know, our lives together as father and son. And I felt, you know, so much love and just like, you know, this thing that I guess I thought, I don't know if I felt like I was missing or whatever, but it just filled me with this immense sense of love, you know, for my father and from my father. You know, I did the same thing with my sister too. You know, and so it doesn't have to be all one shot. You don't have to just put the clip notes out there or anything. It's just like, you know, it's something that will stick with you. And you'll continue to learn from, and, you know, hopefully, you know, you just do your best.
You know, we left off when we were trying to get into the food details at the food truck. But since time is a little bit limited, I want to see if we can attempt to talk about from the minute you got the food truck to today, sort of like that journey, if you will, in a few minutes as we're closing out the episode. And then maybe perhaps in another episode, you know, a few months later, we can talk about, you know, we can pick up where the food truck is. I'm sorry, for your operations, your food operations, and really get into that in a separate episode. But I do want to hear from the point that you got the food truck and how it developed into where you are today.
Yeah. So with the food, I found that through food, that was the best way for me to kind of articulate, you know, my experience, like everything that I learned that I wanted to so badly share with the world. I found that that was going to be the best vehicle to do that, the most accessible, and also because of the impacts that food had on me as well. So, you know, I just thought, like I said, on a whim, I found a really cheap, like, beater food truck. It was like a 1959, like, Ford, like, step van that used to be like an Italian Hobie truck or something. Fixed it up for a summer with my friends and was able to run it for, like, you know, I think like maybe like a week or two or something. And it went really well. Like, people were like super excited and really supportive. So then shut it down for the winter and then came back for the next summer, ran a whole season with it. And, you know, it was incredible, just the amount of support and excitement that the community had for it. And, you know, I started off just because of my limitations and everything, so I had a really small menu. I was basically just doing banh mi sasiu, and then I would do like banh quan, or like, you know, just like different random specials and stuff like there. But mainly it was banh mi. And knowing all this time that, you know, I was holding pho in my back pocket, because I knew how good it was, you know, good my mom's recipe, or at least where it was. And I knew that as soon as, like, I kind of, like, you know, would as soon as I served it, that it was just going to open up a whole another, you know, another beast of sorts. So I held on to that until the very end. I think it was like November or something. It was getting a little bit colder, so I decided to do pho.
Serve it out of the truck?
Serve it out of the truck.
Wow.
And lo and behold, lines all the way across the market. I mean, it was just massive, really successful. Couldn't even keep up. Learned a lot. This whole thing was trial by fire, you know. And it finally got to, I think, December. And then I put an announcement out that I was, you know, shut it down for the season because, you know, I was going to travel again. And the whole community was just like up in arms. Just like, no, please don't, kind of thing. So I held on to it and actually served through like snowstorms with like lines of people standing in the snow, just like trying and get fun and everything.
Wow.
And I served up until I think 2 days before I left to go back to Peru. And so did that, shut it down. And then the following year, because of the success, and you know, the farmer's market had moved to this brand new, beautiful facility. They offered me a spot inside there. And so out of the food truck, Mamang, which is the name of the food stall, was born. And so, and it's been a crazy ride. That was, I think 8 years ago now. And, you know, we opened up there, and within the first 3 months of being there, I was on the Food Network. You know, it was just, everything just kind of like took off, basically. And again, trial by fire, learning everything. I was just like working crazy hours, just trying to keep up with everything. And, you know, through the rest of the year, I kind of figured it out, and had this really solid, like, you know, workflow and system and everything down. And so, did that, and you know, through the course of the next couple of years, like, I had a bunch of like kind of like carrots dangled in my front of my face of like people wanting me to open up in Grand Rapids, or like, you know, open up here or partner here, this there, whatever kind of thing. And you know, the whole time for me, I just, you know, they're just all opportunities for me to really just kind of like analyze situations, really just kind of dig into myself and my purpose and like why I was doing these things, and then ultimately, you know, realize that these weren't the things that like were kind of serving what I was trying to do with food. And so I was turning down. Also during this time, because I was in, in the food world now, I was hanging out with other chefs and everything. You know, we would get together and, just kind of have like drinks like after our shifts and things like that. And never forget it, but like they, you know, we would sit around and it was just like this round table about with the chefs just talking about how much they hated working at their places. And how much they hated this chef and like this chef, and they'd all bounce around these different kitchens and stuff, and just sounds so freaking awful and like toxic. And I remember just being just bewildered, and like finally I asked him, I was like, "Well, this sounds horrible. You're like, why are you guys doing this? Like, this sounds like it sucks." And they all just kind of chuckle and just like, "This is how it is, man." You know, they're all super passionate about, you know, cooking, and wanting to cook the food that they want to cook, but like, you know, this was the setup, the culture, and everything, and they just kind of sat and ate it. And I remember right then and there making the decision that I would never run an establishment that was like that. And from there, I was on a mission basically to change everything. And so that summer, I think, or fall, I started Flint Social Club, and started it as a pop-up series as a way for my chef friends to be able to cook the food that they wanted. I leveraged my relationships and infrastructure with Mamang, you know, community partnerships and everything as well, and basically had a sponsored pop-up series. I think we did 5 of them or something, each one featuring a different chef and the food that they wanted to do. And once again, the community came out, all of them sold out. It was like, you know, it's awesome, super fun, massive success. And throughout the following year after that, I kept getting hit up by all these people that saw it and just like, man, like, I want to do something. I don't know how to do it. Like, you know, want to get their foot in, or whatever it was. And so then the following years, my chef friends and I turned into mentors. And we would take on, people from the community that wanted to, you know, get into the food world, and we would do pop-ups with them. Each year kind of grew a little bit larger and bigger and everything. And, you know, that was kind of like the starting point of how Flint Social Club, how Flint Social Club started. Parallel to this, I think 3 years after I had been running Mamang, I was outreached by an old high school friend who was up in Traverse City. And he said that he had a client that was looking to open a Vietnamese restaurant up there. And she was asking if I wanted to come up and consult. So I was like, yeah, sure. So I made a trip to go up there and met someone named Soon Haggerty. She's a Vietnamese person. And she, you know, she's also from Southern California as well. And she was in Traverse City and, had worked in marketing for like the auto industry. She's like really successful and everything, but she had always had this desire to open up a Vietnamese restaurant. She wanted to do it as a nonprofit, because she really wanted to be able to leverage our culture and our food to be able to do good. And so I get up there and I meet her, and basically within the first hour, so many things of like our stories and our family history and everything aligned to where we realized that we really wanted to get, to do this together. So we created the Good Bowl, and you know the business model that helps the community there. And so the model is that a dollar from every bowl is donated to a local, national, or global charity. We switch up the charities every quarter, and the community gets to vote on which
Wow.
ones. And I can say really proudly that over the past 3.5 years, we've raised over $100,000, mostly for local charities that we've given away. In addition to that, we came together on the fact that we really wanted to create a good working culture, combat the toxicity of the food industry, and definitely have been able and successful to build a really amazing crew that offers a lot of care and respect and dignity to one another. We're employee first kind of establishment, and and believe that if we treat employees well, then that still translates to happy food and happy customer service. It was this really kind of amazing thing. Like, really what we connected on was that, we're both refugees. Our families are refugees. She came over on a boat in the second wave. Her family was able to, come to Southern California and just, build up this really amazing, kind of produce like company. They were really successful, and she was really grateful for the opportunity and the open embrace that America had for her family, and obviously was for my family as well. So, for us, this we kind of articulated as this was kind of like our thank you to America for giving our family this opportunity, and we wanted to do good by it. So yeah, that's where kind of like my all my businesses and everything kind of entail. The Good Bowl is still going really strong. We're still at the farmers market and with my mom, and kind of this next phase of life for me is really delving more into the nonprofit side of things, which Flint Social Club officially organized as last year. And yeah, we're just out here to be able to do good and to provide the same opportunities basically that were afforded to myself and my family, just make sure that those continue.
Your journey is inspiring to me, and I thank you so much for sharing so much of the details of the things that you've gone through to get to the point that you are today. So once again, thank you for coming on and sharing.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
We'll talk soon, Tony. Thank you again.
All right, thanks, Skip. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.